Health and Human Services Policy Committee will come to order.
Thank you, Jen. And we are meeting today on really an overview on case management and the effects of a lot of the federal changes, what effect they'll have on the state, and what effect they're having on the ground at the county level. And let's just get right into it. So, Mr. Engstrom, there we go, thanks, and Ms. Broomfield. And please identify yourself for the record. Thanks for coming today, and tell us what we need to know.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dan Engstrom. I'm the Human Services and Public Health Director in Hennepin County. With me today is Judith Broomfield. She is the Assistant Director of Scott County Community Services. We're going to be doing a little bit of a tag team presentation here this afternoon. What I'd like to do to start out with is, first of all, just highlight that there is a packet of information that has been distributed. And when we talk about targeted case management, it gets fairly complex. So we did include in the packet some case examples for your reference later or for questions later. We hope that that will help explain more of the real detail about how it impacts the clients and consumers that we serve in our respective counties. Target case management was first introduced in Minnesota in the early 1990s, and since that time, counties, either directly or through community organizations, have been able to increase their capacity to serve vulnerable populations by expanding services into community sites and also improving services through reduced caseload sizes and interdisciplinary teams. Our ability to link people to needed services has helped consumers remain in the community and avoid or reduce utilization of far more restrictive and costly alternatives. Targeted case management is a federal Medicaid option. It's authorized under the Federal Social Security Act, and it permits the state to target broadly defined case management services to very specific groups. Targeted case management is a Medicaid entitlement. Once a group is defined, every member of that group who is enrolled in Medicaid is entitled to receive case management. In Minnesota, the federal government pays 50% of the cost of targeted case management services, and counties are responsible for the other 50%. Just to give you some reference to dollar amounts, in federal fiscal year 2006, Minnesota counties expended approximately $82.7 million in property taxes for targeted case management services. Minnesota's state Medicaid plan defines four main types of targeted case management with four main target groups. And I'll just review those with you quickly. Child welfare, or CWTCM, this is targeted towards children experiencing or at risk of abuse or neglect or out-of-home placement. There's children's mental health targeted case management. This is targeted towards children diagnosed with severe emotional disorder. There is adult mental health targeted case management, and this is targeted towards adults with severe and persistent mental illness. And the last main targeted case management is vulnerable adults and developmental disabilities. This is targeted towards adults in need of protective services and those with developmental disabilities. Now, there's one more type of targeted case management. It's called relocation services coordination. This is targeted towards adults residing in nursing homes or other institutions that are transitioning into the community. The difference with this targeted case management program is that the non-federal share is paid for by the state of Minnesota, not the county. Historically, counties have used targeted case management dollars to fund activities such as transporting children from foster care to visitation with parents, linking individuals and families to other needed services such as chemical dependency treatment, anger management, parenting assessments. We've provided services to children while in placement, and we've provided coordination between other professionals working with an individual or a family. The majority of targeted case management dollars in Minnesota are targeted to the child welfare population. This includes families involved with the child protection system. For the past 13 years, Minnesota has had an approved state plan for child welfare. Targeted case management services provided under this plan have helped Minnesota reverse the growth in out-of-home placements. It's reduced the length of stay in placement. It's shortened the timeline for placing children into permanent stable homes. And it's increased the safety for children and reduced recidivism back into the child protection system. I'd like to turn this over to Ms. Brumfield now that will talk a little bit more about some historical context here.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Judith Brumfield, and I'm the Deputy Director of Community Services in Scott County, and here representing both NACSA and AMC. I wanted to go a little bit further into the background and the historical perspective of our targeted case management and all of our case management services. These services were initiated, the targeted case management, in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, and began with child welfare targeted case management. The objective of those case management services at that time was referral to needed mental health, medical, social, educational services, and monitoring and follow-up with these families. The intent of initiating these services was to reduce our out-of-home placement of children to prevent the need for placement of children in residential facilities or foster care. In Minnesota, we recognized early on that out-of-home placement as a primary intervention should not be either used as the first option or forced by lack of services in the community. And we were leaders among states in this respect in developing a system of care for our children that supported children living with their families. This service was consistent with our priority in Minnesota for community-based services. We've been a leader in Minnesota with a number of target populations. At the time we initiated child welfare targeted case management, we had successful models of community-based services for our disability population and for our elderly population through our MRRC waiver and through our elderly waiver. We also recognized that this type of program gave us a great deal of flexibility in providing individualized services for children and for families as opposed to an institutional model or a one-size-fits-all services. So our success in case management allowed us to provide these community-based care rather than care in a state hospital, nursing home, or other institutions. We also saw this as prevention and early intervention as a long-term cost avoidant model. Anytime you can provide primary care early on in the beginning of any kind of disability, it's far less costly than waiting until later on you have to provide deep-end medical care or institutional care. So knowing this about our disabled populations, we translated this knowledge to our children who are vulnerable, who have been victims of physical, sexual abuse or neglect. I need to make clear that one of the things we recognized at that point in time is that Medicaid pays for institutional care. So anytime we could avoid institutional care, by using Medicaid dollars in a less expensive way, we were saving money for the state. Minnesota matches, as Mr. Anson told us earlier, 50% of all of our Medicaid dollars. So we were saving both state and federal money by going to a less costly community-based model. In addition to that, community-based services really are what our families want. It's what the citizens of Minnesota want. Most people don't want to have to leave their home to get the kind of care that allows them to be more independent. Our success in child welfare targeted case management led us as a state to develop this type of case management for other target populations. So we moved into these services for adults with mental health and later for adults who were vulnerable in some way or had developmental disabilities. Another thing to point out is that once we moved to targeted case management, for the most part, rather than the state paying 50% match to federal funding, county pays its match. We use targeted case management to allow us as county to develop programs at a local level without further investment of state funds. If these programs were not in place, many of the beneficiaries of these services would be using Medicaid funds in an institutional setting, which would then have cost state dollars. So by instituting these programs, we not only expanded services in Minnesota, but we expanded services without utilization of additional state dollars. Another issue with these programs is that the funds were required to be reinvested within the programs. They could not be, you could not supplant other county dollars or reduce programs once you began bringing in these funds. So we use these funds not only to provide services at the first level, but over the past 10 to 12 years, we've invested these funds to support the growth of programs for disabled individuals and for a vulnerable children's population without additional state funds. These funds have presented drastic cuts of services at the county level at a time when the state was suffering from budget shortfalls and looking for other means to reduce funding. In summary, Minnesota has been a leader in preventative health care, and we've used these targeted case management models to avoid more costly long-term institutional care. The Deficit Reduction Act, therefore, will have a disproportionate impact on Minnesota because we have used preventative health care as opposed to institutional health care. And there's a potential for a fairly dramatic increase in state dollars required if we are not able to provide these types of community-based services on an ongoing basis, because many of these people will indeed need institutional care if we can't provide them community-based care. I believe at this point we're going to have a report from the Department of Human Services on an overview of the case management regulations.
And members, I think we'll just go through this as well before we start asking questions, if that's all right.
Good morning, Representative Thiessen and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Nathan. I'm with the Federal Relations Division of the Department of Human Services. The federal regulations we're discussing today were formally issued in the Federal Register on December 4, 2007. As interim final rule. They implement the changes in the federal Medicaid program as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 and earlier statutory amendments related to targeted case management. As Mr. Engstrom has very amply described for you, we have a number of CMS approved, that would be Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services approved state plan provisions related to targeted case management. The effective date of these federal rules are March 3rd, 2008. Comments are due February 4th, 2008. That would be next Monday. The department has already submitted its formal comments, and we did so on January 25th, 2008, and there are handouts that have been provided and reproduced.
Everybody has them.
Yes, for the community. Thank you. They've also been posted to the DHS website. Because this is an interim final rule, it will take effect on March 3rd, 2008, whether or not CMS decides to amend it further based on the comments it receives. CMS's stated purpose in the regulation is to implement the statutory changes brought about by the Deficit Reduction Act and other earlier statutory amendments to the Social Security Act. However, via a conference call on December 13, 2007, CMS staff informs the state that CMS is now interpreting this regulation to apply to all forms of Medicaid case management, whether or not the care is provided under the state plan category of case management and targeted case management that Mr. Engstrom described for you. This means that CMS considers the requirement of the regulation to also apply to case management under the various home and community-based waivers and any other form of case management covered by Medicaid. It's unknown at this time how this announcement may affect categories of service such as physician services and other primary and acute care, and how it may affect our current claim for federal matching funds on certain administrative expenditures. I'd like to briefly highlight six major issues the department has identified regarding this regulation, which are more fully covered in the comments that you've received as a handout. First issue relates to the effective date. The regulation becomes effective March 3rd, 2008, as I've indicated. On the December 13th conference call, CMS staff acknowledged that states would be in various stages of compliance with the new regulation on that date, and yet they elected not to allow time for transition. Second issue has to do with the reg's exclusion of other programs. The regulation excludes from the definition of case management services those activities that are, quote, integral components of another Medicaid service. The regulation also excludes activities that constitute the direct delivery of underlying medical, educational, social, or other service to which an eligible individual has been referred. And in that case, the regulation specifically refers to guardianship, child welfare, child protection, parole, probation, and special education as underlying programs. The effect of excluding these services and activities essentially means that federal financial participation is unavailable to cover them as case management services. The third issue has to do with bundled rates. The regulation requires that payment rates for case management services must be paid on a unit of service that does not exceed 15 minutes. Reducing billing units to 15-minute increments increases the complexity of the billing process and is likely to increase the administrative cost at the state, federal, and provider levels. This will affect all forms of targeted case management in Minnesota. It's unknown how CMS plans to apply this requirement to administrative expenditures. The fourth issue is the so-called one case manager rule. The regulation requires that the state provide comprehensive case management services to a client through one case manager. At first blush, this sounds reasonable. People should not have to have multiple case managers conducting overlapping assessments, care plans, etc. However, in cases involving Medicaid enrollees with multiple and complex medical needs, this approach is not workable. This is especially problematic if the regulation applies to administrative activities, such as long-term care consultation and home and community-based waiver case management, in addition to the state plan forms of targeted case management. The fourth issue relates to case management for people in institutions. Because the federal agency, CMS, believes that discharge planning is paid for through payment rates to institutional providers, this regulation limits payments for targeted case management to 60 days for people residing in institutions for 6 months or more, and to 14 days for people residing in institutions for less than 6 months. This is a change from current policy, which allows for unlimited case management as needed within the six-month window prior to discharge. There was also concern that the regulatory requirement that case management only be paid upon successful integration into the community may dampen activities in this vital area. The sixth and final issue I'm going to touch on relates to the freedom of choice, gatekeeping, and administrative decisions sections of the reg. The regulation requires that individuals be able to choose their own case manager. Also, clients have the right to refuse case management services altogether. CMS states in the regulation that permitting case managers to perform gatekeeping functions is a restriction on access to services, yet it's still defined. Finally, CMS states that authorization of medical services is a Medicaid administrative function and must be billed as administrative costs, not as case management. All of these requirements put together create a particular concern for case management under Minnesota's home and community-based waivers, where the county case manager develops and approves the care plan for waiver services and is key to assuring that the federal health and safety requirements are met. In addition, as I said, many of the terms used in the regulation are ill-defined and beg for clarification. In conclusion, the department believes that the regulation exceeds the scope of CMS's authority under the Deficit Reduction Act and the Medicaid provisions of the Social Security Act. The regulation will diminish the ability of systems to work together, which contradicts the very purpose of case management. Finally, the regulation fails to give states clear guidance on a case management structure that will be acceptable to CMS. For these reasons, we have requested in our comments that CMS withdraw this regulation. I'm happy to answer any questions this committee may have.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Ganazin, I'm interested in the health care end of this, and would this apply to care management done with the MCHO and MENDO program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley. At this time, we do not fully know the extent of the application of these regulations. There is one thing stated in the regulations, and yet other things were stated in the conference call that the state had with CMS. So quite frankly, the exact scope of these regulations is not fully known to the department at this time, and we have concerns that it will affect all forms of case management, including case management in the areas you mentioned.
President Hoey.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Knazen, then what I'm also thinking about is healthcare reform. And one of the things we've talked a lot about is chronic disease management and paying for care managers that currently aren't paid for. Would that be prohibited? I assume you'll give me this. It's unclear. I assume is what you're going to say.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that would be my answer. I'm afraid it's ditto, that we simply don't know the full extent of the application of these regulations at this time and have the same concerns you have.
Representative Rossler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Knazen. I think you've laid out a really good case of why CMS has probably exceeded their authority and exceeded the congressional direction under the Deficit Reduction Act. Have you, as an agency, been in discussion with the Attorney General's office and other states about potentially legally challenging these, seeking whether or not there's an injunction possibility? And have you also explored working through and lobbying through our congressional delegation to have Congress intercede, because this is obviously a major change in the delivery system?
Mr. Lawford, we have had conversations with probably every possible stakeholder at this point, which includes other states and legal representatives from within and outside of the state. But at this point, nothing has been landed on with respect to anything the state might legally do. There is some action at the federal level that I believe introduced yesterday, and I think Katie Burns, who is going to be addressing the committee after me, will probably be able to indicate further about that Senator Coleman and Senator Klobuchar have introduced some legislation that will indeed affect and basically, I believe, have set a moratorium for this regulation. But that's all the information I have about this at this time. Excuse me, I believe Katie Burns will have more, a little bit more when she comes up.
Further questions? Okay. Can I just to back up a little bit, maybe, or a long way, maybe. The issues that you raised then, in terms of the scope of the regulation, that really has to do with whether it's just going to be state plan programs or also get into waivered services, and then even within state plans, exactly what kind of services will be excluded. So one of your points is there's just a lot of ambiguity about that. Is that fair?
Representative, that's correct.
Okay. And then in the section on direct care, can you just go over that one more time, exactly what the concerns are, kind of starting with where we are today and what it would, and any of you can answer that, I guess, and what it would exactly stop from happening?
Representative Cheeson, I think there are perhaps other people presenting later on the agenda who can speak to the ripple effect of this.
Okay.
I'm probably not the best qualified person to answer that question to you at this point.
Well, why don't we just move on, and maybe some of that will come up as we move through this. That's great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And you know, hopefully you can keep us posted on this as well.
We certainly will.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we wanted to take a few minutes to talk about more practically or from a particular case standpoint what some of the issues are that have been addressed. So we wanted to kind of take some of these categories and give you an example of what that would mean for us. The first one we wanted to talk about actually addresses your last question of what will this mean in terms of direct care. Because the only clear piece of the interim regulations are that we would no longer be allowed to claim any targeted case management for child protection, as well as a couple of other direct services. What this will mean for us is that the state informed us that effective the end of February, we will no longer be claiming targeted case management for any child protection services. An example of what that will mean is if you can visualize the old way of providing child protection services would be like an emergency room. You get a report of a maltreatment, you investigate, you make a determination of how safe the child is based on what's happening in the family at that point in time, and you move on. So an example would be that if you have, and this is written in front of you, a child where there's a report that the child has been physically abused, you do an investigation and find that indeed this has happened, but the abuser has moved out of the home and is no longer part of the family. You would close that child protection case because the child is safe at this point in time. What we've been able to do with targeted case management is the further assessment and find out what was happening in that family, that the other parent was allowing in someone who might damage their child, that they were unaware of what was going on. You would also be able to look at what having this kind of abuse might have done in terms of impacting the child, and does this child need some additional mental health services? Are there physical issues that need to be taken care of? A case manager would be able to coordinate all of this, work with the family to the point that the family was stable and felt like they could continue to move ahead with their lives and protect their children. That's a service that will disappear.
A few other points of impact on the county. This week, the state released the $32.7 million in targeted case management contingency reserve funds, which were appropriated by the legislature in 2007. This was to help mitigate the impact of targeted case management provisions of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. The appropriation of these funds is based on an estimated targeted case management loss for the 17-month period between the regulation effective dates of March 3rd of 08 to the end of the state fiscal year of 09. As the handout you've received illustrates in some detail, for instance, in child welfare targeted case management, this has allowed us to dedicate staff focusing on addressing the needs of children in foster care, while the traditional child protection worker must handle the court-related work and focus on whether the parent is meeting the requirements necessary to reunite with their children. The child service worker has allowed us, and these are what we use these funds to pay for, this worker has allowed us to assure that the children get needed health, educational, social, and other services to meet their needs. It's also allowed us to provide support to the foster care parents facing the challenges that they have with the placement. And it's helped us to develop a broader array of quality foster care homes. Without child welfare targeted case management, it's very unlikely that we would be able to continue these types of services. In Hennepin County, we anticipate the loss of targeted case management revenues equaling about $13 million in 2008 alone. Nearly all of this will be coming from the child welfare targeted case management area. The impact of the loss of these funds is very difficult to overstate, and it really will put a major problem for us and challenge in a protection system that we have in our county, and be able to continue the preventive work that we've put together in the past. I think one other impact is our ability to pass federal audits, such as the Child and Family Services Review. This will be a big challenge. Federal targets around time and placement, return to placement, secondary reports and maltreatment will be very difficult for us to reach. Hennepin County and all the counties will face financial and legal consequences if we fail to pass these audits.
If the targeted case management rules go into effect, do these programs not become entitlements anymore then, even though the county is paying for some of them? Do you have any flexibility in just not offering services to some people and not others? Does that question make sense?
That question makes sense, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer it. The department may have a better answer. For the most part, if you are providing this as a Medicaid service, it's an entitlement. If it no longer is a Medicaid service, it may not be an entitlement in that same respect. On the other hand, most of these are mandated services by the state. So we don't have the option of not providing child protection services. It's the degree to which you help the family that is really at risk.
Okay.
I think another comment in terms of impact on this is our system is currently built on a network of contracted and operated case management providers. In Hennepin County, we contract with nearly 36 community agencies to provide case management for mentally ill and developmentally disabled adults and children. The new administrative requirements, as you heard previously, 15-minute increments, one case manager, separation of the targeted case management from administrative case management, this will be onerous for small nonprofit organizations that we currently contract with, and we're very unsure at this point what their ability to handle these type of regulations will be. They'll be under the same regulations as the county. We do have Jennifer Hull from Heart Connection, and we would like to be able to ask her to speak a little bit more on the impact on nonprofits. Heart Connection is currently working with the metro counties on efforts around preventing homelessness, and as we begin to talk about these regulations and our contractual relationships, we're learning more impact from our contractors and vendors, and Jennifer is here to share some of that impact with you also.
Great. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Hull. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called Heart Connection, and I think my job here today is to help you understand a little bit about what this means on the street, literally, because what we do is help people who are living outside and living in shelters move into homes of their own and support them in that process. We manage three regional projects in partnership with 26 counties around the state, really looking at long-term homeless supportive housing programs to help people who have serious mental illness, chemical dependency problems, chronic medical conditions, histories with the criminal justice system, histories with out-of-home placement as kids and in their families, help them break the cycle of homelessness and move into homes of their own, recognizing that when people have a home, that becomes the kind of fundamental foundation for them to be able to work on other areas in their lives. We use funding from multiple sources to provide both the housing and the services that people need in order to break the cycle of homelessness. I was looking at two books today that were published by the federal government, one by the Department of Health and Human Services and one, Housing and Urban Development, Strategies for Reducing Chronic Street Homelessness, and a blueprint for change, ending chronic homelessness for people with serious mental illness and co-occurring substance use disorders. And the federal government says to us in these documents that in order to end long-term or chronic homelessness, as they call it, you need to have a do-whatever-it-takes case management approach. They suggest using programs like targeted case management. They even acknowledge how difficult it is for providers to cobble together fragmented funding streams to offer a comprehensive intervention. At least they have a clear picture of what it's like on the streets for us. The targeted case management covered activities, assessing, planning, monitoring, referring, and linking, are a big part of what we do to get people off the street, into housing, and on a path to health, recovery, and self-determination. And it's a critical component of how we pay for these services. In our original supportive housing pilot, we were able to build targeted case management for eligible activities for eligible clients, both children and single adults. The state was investing $1.5 million per year in the program, which allowed us to leverage federal Medicaid targeted case management revenue of another $500,000 per year. We stopped billing child welfare targeted case management for pilot participants last July because of the direction it was clear the feds were headed. That was a loss of $150,000 in revenue. We stopped billing the vulnerable adult targeted case management program in December because there was too much uncertainty for the counties to move forward with that program. That was another $50,000 of revenue lost. Since 2006, we've been able to help more people break the cycle of homelessness thanks to the new Department of Human Services Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. Today, we're helping over 200 families and 470 children in conjunction with the nonprofit and government partners that are part of the picture that I handed out to you. The vast majority of these kids met the criteria for child welfare target case management under the old rules. These are children in extremely vulnerable situations, kids who are camping outside, sleeping in cars, bouncing from house to house, oftentimes have a variety of different adults coming and going from their homes. They have parents with undiagnosed and untreated mental illness, oftentimes active drug and alcohol abuse. If we still had access to a bundled monthly rate of $663 per child per month, that would be as much as $1.8 million in federal Medicaid revenue to help us support these families and children as they break the cycle of homelessness. We now have 320 single adults who are receiving supportive services in our program. At the old rate, the bundled monthly rate of $900, with about 80% of single adults eligible, that's another $1.7 million of federal revenue that we would be able to bring to help us with this big initiative to end long-term homelessness. The work that we're doing in Minnesota is a nationally recognized best practice. To do it, we must provide intensive case management services as well as a whole range of other things people need. Our partners do this out in the field, oftentimes in fairly chaotic, non-linear circumstances. The documentation burden of shifting to a 15-minute increment and the strict rules around what is a case management activity and what is not will greatly reduce our ability to bill Medicaid, even though what we are doing is improving the health and mental health of some very sick people. We're already fighting inadequate funding in the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund, lack of Section 8 rental assistance, difficulty accessing emergency assistance, and the list goes on. Do whatever it takes, intensive case management, the model the federal government is advocating for ending chronic homelessness, does not compartmentalize itself into the neat covered and uncovered activities that the rule suggests. If a frontline worker is driving a participant with serious and persistent mental illness to the grocery store so that we can make sure that they eat, and talking about what the person did yesterday, are they assessing and monitoring, which is covered, or are they transporting, which is not? If we're helping a person with schizophrenia navigate the healthcare system and put into place good eating practices to manage their diabetes, are we doing something related to their mental health care or not? If you're helping a person with severe depression negotiate a difficult situation with their landlord or the police, have you crossed over from assessing and referring to actually doing something? These are the questions that the frontline staff will need to ask themselves every 15 minutes under the new regulations. They do work that can get pretty gritty. They're getting great outcomes. And for the sake of the Deficit Reduction Act, they'll be spending more and more time weighing these technical questions and documenting every 15 minutes of their interaction instead of spending 15 minutes more with clients. Intensive, flexible, integrated programs like ours get and keep people off the streets and out of shelter. When people who were homeless are housed, they aren't showing up in the emergency room as often. They don't end up in jail or in detox as often. When people are homeless, they end up in costly crisis and institutional settings. Investing in integrated programs for people with multiple needs makes sense, common sense and fiscal sense. In the long run, it saves money and saves lives. Ending long-term homelessness is something that we know how to do, but we need investments in accountable, do-whatever-it-takes programs to make this vision a reality. Thanks for letting me present to you today.
Any questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, this concludes our remarks in terms of some of the impacts that we see at the county level. We again have provided you with some handout material that goes into more definition of the role of targeted case management in the various populations that we are serving, and we've included some very specific case examples that we see day in and day out at the county. That's helpful to the community.
It's been very helpful. On this issue of bundled rates, then, under current contracts with some of the vendors, then you're actually doing like a per member per month model of coverage, and then that money can be used flexibly however they see fit to get the outcome, and that will no longer be possible.
Mr. Chair, the current rate is based on the cost, the average cost of providing that service for a particular client, and it's part of the state plan that the federal government approved, where there is a study done for counties called a random moment study that approximate how much time each social worker spends on services that can be covered under case management. That
along with the cost to the county, develops a rate, and then the county matches, or the federal government pays 50% of that. For our contracted vendors, each county determines the cost of that service and averages it out. So one client might receive 20 hours of service and another client might receive 3 hours of service, but your payment is the same for either client. But it is to reimburse the cost of the service. That's the bundled rate. So you don't have to figure out how much time you spent, simply that you serve that client that month.
Okay, that's helpful. That's what I was hearing then. Okay, thank you.
I think at this point, Katie Burns from the department was going to talk a little bit about the next steps.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record, if you would.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Burns. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I work in the Office of Management and Budget, and I'm coordinating the department's activities with regard to the new federal regulations. Thank you for including me today. Shortly after the rules publication, we formed an internal steering committee with broad agency representation to identify issues in the rule, how the rule might affect Minnesota's case management system, and how we might implement these significant new requirements. And as you can imagine, these discussions are ongoing. DHS's Chief of Staff has communicated regularly with county human service directors and tribes about the rule and will continue to do so. DHS distributed a summary of the rule to counties and tribes earlier this month, as well as a draft set of our comments to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. 2 weeks ago, we met with 11 counties to talk about the rule, including Hennepin, Ramsey, Stearns, Pipestone, Pine, Yellow Medicine, Rock, St. Louis, Anoka, Dakota, and Scott counties. Both DHS and counties share many similar concerns and questions about the rule, and we also heard some questions from counties that we hadn't thought about ourselves, and we appreciated that feedback and look forward to continue to working with counties and tribes. We also had a conference call with several tribes last week to share similar information and concerns. As my colleague pointed out earlier in her remarks, it is not possible to implement most of the rules new requirements by the effective date, both because of the vagueness of the regulation and because of the significant restructuring of state case management systems that this rule will require, not only in Minnesota but in states across the country. CMS has acknowledged this point in verbal conversations with states. One point of the new rule, however, is clear, and that is that child welfare targeted case management in its current form will no longer qualify for federal financial participation after March 3, 2008. To that end, DHS has advised counties and tribes to stop claiming for child welfare targeted case management services provided after February 29, 2008. We are asking all parties, counties, tribes, and contracted providers to maintain their data collection structure in the event that Congress delays the effective date of this rule or that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services revises the rule in such a way that federal financial participation could support these activities retroactively. We will continue to bill for all other types of currently approved Medicaid case management even after March 3, 2008. You may be aware that some efforts are underway.
Can I just clarify that?
Yes.
So for the children's mental health, adult mental health, and the vulnerable adults, you'll continue to bill for that?
That's correct.
Okay.
Even after the rule goes into effect. We clearly know that that we will need to make changes to these systems, and this the fact that we will continue to bill by no means suggests that we can allow those activities to go on as they currently exist, but we're just not able to implement the provisions of the rule as they relate to those case management.
There's just not time?
I'm sorry?
There's just not time to do it?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I would also say, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that it is there's not time to do it, and because of the vagueness of the rule, we couldn't do that because the path to compliance is not clear.
Okay. Representative Lofler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Ms. Burns,
Is there even an infrastructure in terms of a data system or anything else for people to, who suddenly have to start billing in 15-minute increments and documenting what exactly type of service they're doing? My understanding, it sounded like from the testimony that, you know, under targeted case management, it happened, you know, you blended a bunch of responsibilities together and coordinated services. And this seems like it's going to be much more complicated at the worker level. Is there even a billing system that's able to get up quickly to initiate that sort of a response on a 15-minute increment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, no, there is. We do not have the ability to simply translate our monthly rates into 15-minute unit rates. And so that will require an enormous amount of work to determine the rates per 15-minute unit of service.
Go ahead. Thank you. Do you know how much, any idea how much that's going to cost? Or is that a county cost as opposed to a state cost?
Mr. Chair, those are questions
we don't know.
Can't answer
okay.
at this point. You may be aware that some efforts are underway to delay or modify the rule at a federal level. Senator Coleman just last night introduced a bill that would delay the rule's effective date until April 1st, 2009. DHS has been very responsive to requests from Minnesota's congressional delegation about our concerns on this rule, and we will have to see how that plays out at the federal level. Finally, as you are well aware, the legislature appropriated $32.7 million last session to counties and tribes to temporarily mitigate the effect of this regulation or a related federal disallowance. The law required DHS to estimate and certify the loss of federal revenue associated with this regulation. Our estimate, based solely on the loss of child welfare targeted case management for the 17-month period from March 1, 2008 to June 30, 2009, is that counties and tribes will collectively lose almost $61 million during the fiscal year 2008 and 9 biennium. I want to just add that this is certainly not a price tag on the cost of this regulation. This is just the piece that we can pinpoint and that we know that we will lose. It's very likely that the true cost of this regulation will well exceed $61 million for the current biennium. Our certification triggers the release of the $32.7 million to counties and tribes. As required by law, the funds were allocated in proportion to aggregate calendar year 2005 targeted case management earnings, and those dollars went to counties and tribes earlier this week. As we move forward, the department will work with counties and tribes on specific policy issues to better understand how the rule may play out on the ground and identify options for implementation. We also welcome the suggestions of other stakeholders on how these new rules may be implemented.
Thank you. Any, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that Minnesota uses these funds perhaps more than other states do and that will be hit harder for that reason, but a lot of these changes would seem to also affect other states. Many of the same ways, and I'm just wondering if there's some concerted effort on the part of the states to work together to hold off some of these changes or to fix some of these problems.
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there are a number of efforts underway by multiple states to raise these issues, so it's certainly not just Minnesota facing serious concerns with this regulation. For example, the National Association of State Medicaid Directors is gathering information, particularly as states have been advised to work with their respective Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services regional offices and trying to get information about what different states are being told as they try to negotiate strategies with the federal government on this, so that there are efforts underway, to your point.
I have a question back to the language of the regulation. I don't know if you or someone else can help, but one of the things it talks about is direct delivery of underlying medical services. Why would Medicaid be getting rid of medical paying reimbursement for medical services? That doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Chair, that sounds like an excellent question. I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer
okay.
it. Lisa, is that something you could...
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Lisa Nazan, also with the Department of Human Services. I believe your question is, perhaps you could repeat it.
Yeah, the direct care rule prohibits Medicaid funds for case management activities that constitute direct delivery of underlying medical services. And I just don't understand why Medicaid couldn't be used to cover medical services, or what are they talking about there?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that what the rule means there is that Medicaid can pay for the underlying medical services, but not the case management component. In other words, the Medicaid service can still be paid for in its direct form, but not the case management part, if there is an underlying direct care medical service that constitutes the actual service.
Okay. Diane, Ms. Nussbaum.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just to try and get our handle on that, and I know all this is fairly vague, but does that mean that a case manager who's working with a person who is one of their challenges is severe mental health issues and they're not responding well to medication, that they would not be paid for costs of reaching out to that medical provider and trying to see if they've heard from the patient about how it is or isn't working, and, you know, sort of intervening, that, you know, Medicare would continue to pay for whatever prescription the doctor wrote, but that any kind of intervention on behalf of the person wouldn't be covered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it's my understanding that the underlying mental health service in your example would still be a covered Medicaid service. But what these regulations are prohibiting is the case management to, in some sense as another layer, manage the provision of that care. I'm looking to some of our other folks in the audience from the department to see if there's a better answer to that question. Looks like I've come close enough. I apologize.
No.
This is a very vague and unclear rule. And if we sound vague and unclear, we're in keeping with the rule, but we are being very honest with you that there are more questions that have come up from this rule than answers.
Mr. Chairman, and I understand the vagueness, and I'm glad you're challenging the rule in a variety of different ways due to that, but the other thing that seems like it could be a major complication is the one manager component of this, and that the people who targeted case management is focused on are the people who are complicated. The easy cases don't need someone coordinating their life. And, you know, it's the people who have, you know, someone who's medically fragile in their family, maybe it's a severely disabled child, the stress of it is, you know, causing the rest of the household to sort of fall apart, and older siblings are acting up or whatever. And so you don't want to have, you know, one part of the system telling the family to do one thing and one another. But the requirement of one manager would seem to say that you couldn't have a medical case manager who's really working with that child with severe disabilities and kind of a real fragile kind of physical, mental situation, and then have someone else who's really working on the whole family with family therapy or those sorts of things. Is that right, that you'd really just have to have one person, and you'd have to pick whether it's the social service stream or it's the medical stream?
Representative Loeffler, you've hit exactly on many of the concerns we have with the one case manager rule. We have gone into some more detail in the regulation comments that have been provided as a handout, and we can, I'm sure, go on at length about the concerns we have about how that rule will apply to, as you say, many Medicaid enrollees who are, by definition, complex and convoluted cases. So I believe you're absolutely right. There are grave concerns about that rule, and we've touched on them in our comments to a large degree.
In the rule, it also refers specifically to Child Welfare Protective Services, and so I'm assuming that's why that's specifically called out, but also parole and probation programs, which are more of a, is that going to affect state? I mean, that's more of a state program, I would assume, or some of it at least. Parole wouldn't be necessarily, but, or maybe both of them actually are county programs.
Mr. Chair, I'm not the best person to answer that question.
And similar for special education programs as well.
Mr. Chair, there are certain components of those things that are listed as excluded that may be part of our child welfare targeted case management. I would like to take that those questions back to the department and get back to you because I'm not in a position to answer them, and I'm not seeing other people in the audience from the department who can answer them at this time.
Okay. Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, a number of counties who have especially juvenile probation as a part of their community services department are using child welfare targeted case management as part of the funding for their juvenile probation offices. I think that's the largest area in Minnesota where this would apply. Other states are far more heavily impacted by this one, but for us it's mostly the juvenile probation in some counties, not all counties.
And what about guardianship? Do we do much there? Is that more other states as well, public guardianship?
Ours is minimal. We certainly do it for a few, but a minimal amount, I think.
One other money question, and I don't know if you've had a chance to do this, but one of the impacts here is that if some of these programs disappear, there's going to be an impact on the state because of the coming back out of the community and into state Medicaid programs. Have we started to run any numbers, as a state, but the department run any numbers in terms of what those effects may be?
Mr. Chair, not at this time.
Okay.
And as things move forward and we get better information, I think we'll be able to be in a better position to give some better sense of scope of the impact of this.
Well, I'm just thinking for the February forecast, that's not going to be incorporated into the February forecast at all.
Mr. Chair, there's very little that could be incorporated into the February forecast given the vagueness of the rule.
Right. Thanks. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Cindy Goodall? Yes, all right, there we go. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee, and I do have handouts here that I can share.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Cindy Goodall, and I am the Community Services Program Director for Courage Center, and I'm here to talk with you about one form of targeted case management that is impacted by this rule, relocation service coordination. And David Hancock from the NCIL is also going to be addressing the committee about these changes. And unfortunately, this part of the rule is actually very clear and pretty devastating. So I first wanted to talk to you about what relocation service coordination actually is. That is a form of case management that works with individuals who are living in a nursing facility or a hospital. It's an entitlement that it has been an entitlement that anybody who is living in those kinds of settings and is on medical assistance is entitled to up to 180 days of targeted case management to find appropriate housing and support services so that they could relocate into a community setting. And, individuals who are in those kind of settings and don't have anywhere to return to, as you can imagine, are quite complex. They oftentimes have multiple disabilities, physical disabilities or health issues, oftentimes mental health disabilities, chemical health issues. A lot of times when they've had to move into the nursing facility, they've lost the housing, and that's what necessitated their return or their stay in the nursing facility, or because they were in the nursing facility for so long, they lost their housing and they don't have anywhere else to go to. So the process relocation service coordination is to meet with the client, determine that they do want to live in the community, talk with them about what kind of success or barriers they've had in the past for living in the community, what their preferences are for where they would like to live, what their support services needs are, other kinds of preferences that need to be taken into account. Do they have pets? Do they smoke? Do they want to live with people or not live with people? Because of where they're going to be living. And this process can take some time, just that whole assessment process and trying to determine what will be the best fit. And then the relocation service coordinator would work with that person to tour available housing options, to connect with available support services, and prepare that person for living in the community. And currently, this 180 days that this person would be able to receive that service, typically the counties have been providing that service, but some of the counties do contract with agencies like Courage Center to provide that service. At Courage, we've been a contracted provider with Hennepin County just since March, but have worked with a number of individuals over the years who have relocated from institutions into the community. The new rule is that if a person is in a nursing home for less than 180 days, they would go from having 180 days to find a new place to 14 days to find new housing and support services. If they've been in the nursing home for more than 180 days, they would get 60 days of that targeted case management. And that is continuous days. So it's not, 14 days spread out over 3 months. It's 14 days and that's it. And then the 60 days, again, is a similar kind of thing. You know, currently it often takes 2 weeks or more just to figure out with the client what it is that they want. And, oftentimes their guardian has to be involved. Their family members have to be involved. And it's a contemplative process. It's not something that people can just make snap decisions about, too. And the 60 days also provides challenges. Even currently, the 180 days is challenging for individuals to be relocated into the community because of waiting lists for available housing and support service options. It doesn't matter how much advocacy the service coordinator does, they cannot move those waiting lists quicker. The person just simply has to wait. And so some housing options, it takes 6 months to a year to get into. The rule change is a very drastic change in this case.
Okay. So just so I understand this, so there's a requirement that we move people out of institutions into the community if they choose, basic under the Olmstead decision? I mean, is that...
Yes.
As long as they can do it, okay. The least restrictive environment.
Yes.
So once that's determined, we have to do that. We don't have any choice. Well, we, the counties or the agencies, have to do that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think David Hancock from MCIL is going to be talking about the Olmstead Supreme Court decision that does mandate that individuals under 65 be offered community living options.
I'll wait till you're both done, and then I'll ask the question. Okay. Okay.
Other challenges that come into play in terms of placing people within 180 days, let alone the 14 days or 60 days, is that, oftentimes people will have a medical crisis or something that will delay their moving, or they'll need to take a break from that process because they need to treat their medical condition or whatever. And, you know, this kind of a time frame or tight time frame would not allow for that to happen. Clients sometimes have different expectations about what it is that they want, where they want to live, and what exactly is available to them for housing and support services. And sometimes that process of matching those things together can delay the process, or sometimes will derail the process, and that will lead to people not being placed. One of the other rules with this regulation is that the provider would only get reimbursed once the person moves into the community. So for a provider who's a nonprofit like Courage Center, we would have that risk that we might not get paid for our services, or we would have to wait until they relocate to get paid for services.
And the current rule is that you get reimbursed as you go?
We bill in 15-minute increments currently for the services that we provide, regardless of whether or not that person does relocate into the community. And like I said, there's lots of different reasons why it doesn't happen. And most of those are outside of the provider's control. It can be a health concern. It could be the person simply changes their mind, or, you know, it doesn't meet their expectations, the available options. So for a provider like Courage Center, with these current rules, we would not be able to provide this service. currently people in counties that do offer contracted case management, you know, have a choice in terms of who their provider is. I don't know how that would work, but it would be very difficult for us to be able to provide this service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I wanted to point out about while we're on the relocation services is that living in the community is generally, even with a bundle of services, cheaper than institutional living. And the state got so serious about it, it put in a penalty on all counties that have people under 65 living in nursing homes. But this has been one of the biggest barriers to getting one out is there's no affordable housing, let alone handicap accessible housing. And so shortening the time frame doesn't create that solution. We've kind of designed a system to fail right now, and having the feds pull out one of the pieces just makes it crumble faster. And I think we're going to have to look at some comprehensive approaches, including talking with our peers in the Housing Committee in order to get these pieces in place. But we're going to see it in our budget as increased costs just because we're not going to be able to get people out.
Mr. Chair, it is the experience that the nursing facilities, while they are helpful in the process, social workers in the nursing facility simply do not have the resources or the capacity to be able to help these people with that transition. They need somebody who is focused on that and is their advocate to be able to move out on their own or into the community. It is a complicated process with a lot of different things that have to get put together, a lot of different pieces, and very time-consuming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you guys want to stay there, well,
sure, that's
okay.
Fine.
Mr. Hancock. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is David Hancock. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. And like the Courage Center, we are one of several vendors in the metropolitan area that provides nursing home relocation services, specifically for people with disabilities who are living in nursing homes. And because of a lot of the information that you've already received this afternoon that I had incorporated into my remarks, I'm going to go off my text here a little bit and hope that I don't lose my way and take you all down a path with me here. In regard to your remarks earlier, Mr. Chair, the targeted case management services offered by CMS specific to nursing home relocation services are actually, as you alluded to it, an offshoot of the Olmstead decision of 1999. The Olmstead decision by the U.S. Supreme Court basically held that individuals with disabilities have the right to live in the least restrictive environment that they choose. And as a result, targeted case management services were begun through CMS to assist individuals with disabilities who identify a desire and state a desire to move out of the nursing home setting or other qualified institutional setting. And that's an interesting qualifier because it's not up to the counties or anyone else to make that assumption for individuals with disabilities. It is based on the fact that a person with a disability living in a nursing home setting indicates their desire to relocate. And that's what starts the clock. That's what starts that trigger for the evaluations that I'm sorry, we've never met. That Cindy referred to a moment ago. I've never had the occasion to meet before. That Cindy alluded to a moment ago. It's what starts that clock for the evaluation process, the referral process, and results in the beginning of that 180-day clock. Now, also, as Cindy mentioned, that 180-day clock up until now has been 180 consecutive days. It doesn't take into account weekends. It doesn't take into account holidays or other interruptions to that coordinated relocation process to assist the individual. So, when that clock starts for somebody, that referral process, that relocation coordination process, you lose anywhere from 40 to 45 days right off the top that are given away to weekends and holidays and other obstructions. The other challenge has been up till this time is that in that 180 days, because of many of those barriers that Cindy mentioned also, the lack of accessible and affordable housing, Representative Laughlin mentioned that as well, the lack of community-based resources. Not everybody lives in an incredible metropolitan area like Minneapolis-St. Paul where there's an abundance of resources out there if we can get people connected to them. This Olmstead decision is national, and it refers to people in Pipestone County just like it does in Hennepin County. So one of the barriers often is finding those community-based services to connect people up to once they relocate out of the nursing home. There are other issues, employment, and things like that, transportation issues that are barriers as well. So the 180 days never took that into account. So if you come to the end of that 180-day calendar and successful relocation has not taken place, there are few, if any, options available to that individual. They don't. The clock does not automatically start again for that person. They have to go back, basically, to the end of the line.
Okay, and the question I have then is, the services then you'd be providing, do you stop then at that point providing the services, or do you have to continue to provide the services until the person gets relocated, but you just don't get paid anymore?
Exactly. Well, Mr. Chair, the latter part of your question is the accurate one.
Okay.
And we have done that on several occasions where we have continued. We know that we're close, so we continue to provide that service beyond the 180th day, but there's no reimbursement for the hours or the time that's put in process.
And because it's triggered by the person's request under Olmstead, the county at least, wouldn't have any choice of whether to continue that process to final placement. Are there options for cutting off the process at some point?
There's the only option that I'm aware of to cut off the process while it's unfolding is if that individual leaves the nursing home for a hospital stay and they come back to the nursing home or are readmitted to a nursing home setting, then it can restart.
But otherwise, there's a constitutional, at least statutory, obligation to continue that process. Okay.
Well, and why it was established as 180 consecutive days, Mr. Chair, is anybody's guess. But the ironic part of all this is, maybe it's not really ironic, maybe that's not the apt phrase to use, but the odd part of this is that while we've been expressing concerns for the past 2 to 3 years about the 180-day rule to begin with, the response we get from CMS is not to expand that, but to, as Cindy described, dramatically reduce that for individuals to repeat. Individuals that are in a nursing home setting for greater than 180 days now have, or under these proposed rules, would have 60 days of coordinated service. For those individuals living in a nursing home or other qualified setting for less than 60 days, they get 14 days. And again, to repeat what Cindy said, that's 14 or 60 consecutive days. So again, it doesn't take into account those interruptions that are on the calendar. And to illustrate that example just a little further, if I might, in the last 3 years, the Metro Center for Independent Living has successfully relocated 68 individuals. That's, and as Cindy said, these are labor-intensive activities. You don't just, move somebody the next day out of a nursing home and into an apartment or a residential site in the community. There is a significant lack of accessible and affordable housing, transportation issues, other community support. Of those 68 individuals that we have successfully relocated in the last 3 years, 54 of those individuals required more than 60 days. The average number of days for MCIL's assisted relocations is 112 days. So we already know that we're behind the eight ball. And we work very cooperatively with both Hennepin and Ramsey County, as does Courage Center. And we know that from our interactions and our communications with both Hennepin and Ramsey County, that because of the high level of confidence in the services that MCIL provides, we are often assigned some of the more difficult cases, which is presumably why we're seeing 112 days. The average age for the individual receiving relocation services is 55 years of age. The range has been between 35 and 91. So, to correct a small myth, the Olmstead decision didn't specify just under the age of 65. The Olmstead decision was for all individuals with disabilities living in a nursing home. The average stay for those individuals in a nursing home was between 7 days and 11 and a half years. The average stay was 364 days. So they're already above that 180-day mark. 41% have been in the nursing home for more than 180 days, and 59% have been in the nursing home for less than 180 days. So 59% of those individuals under these new rules would qualify for only 14 days of relocation services. The length of the relocation coordination averaged for us between 4 days, which is a quick one, and 269 days. As I mentioned earlier, the average was 112. And the range in staff hours for us was between 0.75 hours up to 202.5 hours. And keeping in mind, as you said, Mr. Chair, that over 180 hours, there is no remuneration for that. Cindy and I have both talked about some of those common barriers that exist in the community, the lack of accessible and affordable housing, transportation issues, accessibility to community-based supports, and et cetera. The other thing that I would mention also just is a couple of years ago, a number of individuals with disabilities, advocates and allies, individuals representing nonprofit organizations, individuals from state government as well, came together around a function called Options 2. And, Mr. Chair, I know that you're very familiar with that. The Options 2 function really charged us, the assembled group, with the responsibility of providing a written report of the current status of the Olmstead implementation process in the state of Minnesota, to identify what some of those ongoing barriers are to that implementation, to identify some of the challenges, and to offer recommendations. In October of 2006, we presented our report to the Minnesota legislature, and in the report was a list of recommendations, and I inform the committee now that we, the Options 2 group, continues to meet, even though we no longer have a specific mandate to do so. We continue to meet to address these recommendations and to work on implementation of those recommendations to our greatest ability. And we're doing that through a coalition and collaborative effort with the Minnesota Coalition for Citizens with Disabilities, with the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, with the Centers for Independent Living Association, and other interested individuals. So we're continuing to try to implement some of those recommendations, again, to our greatest degree. But I would encourage the committee that if you want to gain more information about the depth of the situation here in Minnesota, some of the current challenges and barriers, what our current status is in terms of implementation of the Olmstead decision, that you might want to pull that copy of that report off your shelf and take it up. Or if you don't have one, let me know, and I'll be happy to make one available to you. The other thing that we've heard this afternoon is the activities on the national level. I know our national association, the National Council on Independent Living, and other national associations have been addressing this very issue to our congressional delegations as well. We've been very fortunate in that Senators Klobuchar and Senator Coleman, along with Senator Crocker from Tennessee, did in fact introduce legislation yesterday afternoon at about 4:30 p.m. We also know that Representative Ellison is considering co-sponsoring a House version. I believe it's House File 5173, I believe is the number. So there are some things happening to create a moratorium on the national level to halt this activity on CMS. But again, as you've heard from other testifiers this afternoon, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services are pretty committed to implementing these recommendations or these proposed changes on March 3rd. So we don't have a great timeline to work on here. But
Representative Chumper, I think, had a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a couple quick questions.
Yes.
Mr. Hancock, couldn't the social service person at a nursing home or family members pick up some of the slack?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure what you mean by slack.
Or, for example, no, if these rules go into effect, I mean, couldn't they pick up the void or cover the doing what you're saying is going to be really difficult to do now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand the question, and right now, having family involvement is already currently a very, very important part of this process. And in fact, a lot of times we have the families very, very involved in helping to select appropriate housing for the individual, getting them connected to community-based support. And a lot of times, once the individual relocates from the nursing home back to an acceptable setting in the community, the family plays a very, very important role, almost supporting the case management function, if you will, because that case management function may no longer continue. One of the barriers for families perhaps being even more involved is that for a lot of the individuals that are relocating out of nursing home or other institutional settings, there's a requirement for accessible and affordable housing, and the families may simply not, the home that they might be able to offer that individual may not be accessible.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I should address that too. You know, oftentimes the people who get stuck in nursing facilities don't have family to help them get out. You know, they don't have anybody who's willing to do that. Oftentimes these are individuals who've had a long history of mental illness, or have had some chemical health challenges in the past, and their families are no longer involved with them. But they still have the right to be living in the community and have the desire to do so. In terms of the nursing facility social workers, you know, that's a position that the nursing facility has to pay for, and, you know, they have their own challenges. Usually it's like one social worker for, I don't know, 60 beds. You know, they're not going to be able to do this time-intensive service that relocation service coordination does. And that's, you know, been typical what we found when we started working with folks is that the social worker from the nursing home is like, yeah, well, whatever you need me to do, you tell me, but I can't do all this. You know, I don't have the time to do this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's an excellent point, is to remember that this process, this relocation process, is very, very labor-intensive. And it's not just finding housing or just finding transportation or just finding a connection to one or multiple community-based services, or sheltered employment or meaningful employment, or it's all of those things. We at MCIL, we employ 4 full-time people that do nothing but nursing home relocation activities.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just one other question.
Yes.
If these rules actually do go into effect, how are you going to accommodate that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll continue to do the best that we can under the 60 or 14 days. I would respectfully suggest, however, that for those individuals living in a nursing home for less than 180 days and are only guaranteed 14 days of coordinated services, it's going to be very, very difficult to complete. I mean, barely begin a process in 14 days, let alone complete it. The other challenge that Cindy mentioned earlier that will be very, very challenging for us and will have to be given serious consideration on what level of involvement we continue to have, is that the relocation coordination services aren't reimbursed until a successful relocation takes place. And our ability, because we're a nonprofit organization, much like Herge Center, our ability to carry the debt for the federal government for a period of time is going to be very, very limited. Now, we have, as part of our core service function at the Metro Center for Independent Living, like every other center for independent living across the country, one of our core focus is advocacy. So we will continue under our core service element to provide whatever limited services that we can to advise on the nursing home relocation process, but to offer the kind of complete service that we do now, it will be severely limited.
So the reality is that probably a lot less people will get relocated.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's very true. And in that statement, that to me is one of my biggest concerns, because what that means in translation is that the thousands of individuals across the United States today that Olmstead was meant to address will no longer have access to that Supreme Court decision. It will be essentially taken away from them by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
Thank you.
Well, and that kind of comes back to my initial question. Someone has to have the responsibility of actually doing this, whether they're paid or not. You know, and so you get a contract from the county, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
And they could maybe even pay you a rate out of their property taxes, I suppose, at some level to do it. But is it the counties then that is going to... Who would someone sue? Well, I mean, that's in there, not me, okay? But at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to, right?
Yes, sir, I believe so. And Mr. Chair, aside from the facetiousness of my previous answer, I would think that, you know, part of that I would, if I were an attorney, I would be looking at, you know, the federal government, because they're the ones that are initiating this reduction and this elimination of access to the Supreme Court decision. One of the conversations that we've had with Hennepin County in particular is, and that they have shared with us, is that their big concern is that they don't have access to property taxes. There's no mechanism within Hennepin County anyway. There's no mechanism within Hennepin County that would allow them to access these dollars for this purpose. So there would have to be some legislative activity at the county level that would free up and allow those dollars to be used for this purpose. But to the terms of your original question, that would make an interesting lawsuit. I think probably the federal government would be the biggest target.
I imagine it's to the county, too. And that's what my guess would be.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I take your point, but I think it's, you know, this responsibility for coordinating the nursing home relocation is a multi-layered pass down.
No, that's fair.
I'm just
thinking at the end of the day, the counties are probably on the hook for this, because they have custodial responsibility for these folks, right?
Right, well, they have the frontline responsibility as well. Yes, you're right, sir.
Oh, the state may get sued. Okay. So it's just someone other than the federal government. Okay, anyway, thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have some handouts.
Oh, thank you.
Speak specifically to the experience.
This is really helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Maxey and Ms. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark Maxey, representing the AFSCME Council 5. I'd like to thank you for holding this hearing. It was 2 years ago that we vigorously, along with a number of other folks in this room, I think, opposed passage of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. And it actually got carried over into February of 2006. And the day passed on a Tuesday. On a Monday afternoon, I was with some of our members who were social workers in the office of Congressman Jim Ramsett up Plymouth. And we asked him if he would oppose the bill. And he said he was thinking about it. The next day he did vote against it. Unfortunately, it did pass. And by two votes in the House, it was signed into law. And we are dealing with effects ever since. And the savings that came from that bill at that time were used to partly pay for a federal tax cut not banked in the Health and Human Services system. AFSCME, we're working with our international union on this. We will, and I think there's a lot of good, concerned, and well-qualified professionals on this, on the state and with the counties. You've heard some of them that have worked on this. Our folks are will by Friday be submitting their comments on it, asking that the proposed final rule be rescinded or at least modified. We're also supporting legislation in the Congress that was alluded to delay or put a moratorium on the rule. And it's our hope that a little over a year from now, a new rule will be in place, a new CMS director, a new Health and Human Services director. To give you a clue, of what may happen, Senators Clinton and Obama voted against the Deficit Reduction Act. Senator McCain voted for it, although he has been known to change his mind. Thank you for the one-time funding, $32.7 million that's been distributed out to help cover the cost. We'll be back. We'll be wanting to work with you, of course, along with the counties and the state. Somehow we need to address this for the long run. We need to go after the feds and try to change it, but we are partners. We need to work with it. At this time, I'll turn it over to one of our members, who's a social worker in Ramsey County, Judy Schultz.
Good afternoon, Chairman Thiessen and
welcome.
Representatives.
And if you could, I guess you were identified. All right, that's fine.
Thank you. I'm Judy Schultz, and I've been a social worker with Ramsey County Child Protection for 41 years. My job certainly is to protect children from neglect and abuse, and I'm also a very proud member of AFSCME 151. My union brothers and sisters are on the front line delivering human services in countries and counties throughout Minnesota. We're the safety net for children at risk, abused children, abused adults, mentally ill, and DV clients. We help our clients gain access to the medical, social, educational, and protective services that they need to become healthy, functioning adults. We save taxpayer money because our services are designated to keep clients out of more expensive services. I'm here today to raise serious concerns about the new TCM cuts. They will take effect on March 3rd. County budgets will get crunched and jobs will be lost. The most important, abused children will be hurt by these. Please work with AFSCME, Council 5, to reverse these damaging federal rules. My department has already suffered severe cuts. Despite the legislature's financial help to mitigate federal cuts, I'd like to tell you what the cuts mean to me and the children I work with. To brace for the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, Ramsey County froze hiring and warned social workers that our already thin ranks would be reduced. With fewer social workers, each of us has less time to devote to individual cases and their families. That's tough when our caseloads are already very heavy. To help you understand our caseloads, you need to know how we process reports of abuse. Ramsey County has a hotline that people call to report child abuse and neglect complaints. Our screeners receive thousands of calls each year. They screen out many calls, and we investigate the rest. Today, we need to see a bruise before a child will get some services. Deeper cuts will force us to tighten the screening criteria because we don't have enough social workers to investigate. Abused children will certainly fall between the cracks. Today, hundreds of families receive child protection services from Ramsey County social workers. Each week, we investigate new reports of abuse or neglect. Professional standards require that I make home visits and conduct face-to-face interviews with the children and their parents. It would be impossible for me to assess risk without direct contact and checking the home. My job cannot be done by phone any more than a doctor can diagnose.
Can I just stop you there for
yes.
a second? So you're licensed.
I'm a licensed child protection worker.
So you actually do have, I never thought about that, so professional standards that you could use your license if you don't do some of these, if you don't provide some of these services.
I could find another job doing something other than child protection.
Or if you don't do something, it could put your license at risk. That's all I'm asking.
I don't think it could put my license
okay.
at risk.
Okay.
It would be putting children at risk.
No, that's fair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. During a home call, I assess risk and determine whether or not and what kind of services to provide. Seldom do parents admit their abuse or even recognize their neglect of the child. That's why it's so important for me to observe the children's living environment for signs of neglect. I also observe the parents for drug or alcohol issues. For each case that's investigated, there's a staggering amount of paperwork. I'm not a bureaucrat. I'm a social worker who cares about my clients. I do my best work face-to-face, not stuck in front of a computer. Cuts always seem to reduce my face time with clients, and no one benefits from that. I've been a CP worker for 41 years. I've learned firsthand that children cannot protect themselves from abusive parents. Social workers like me are often the only shield they have. We must protect services that protect children. I encourage you to pressure the federal government to reverse its rules that would deny Medicaid reimbursement for child protection services. Once again, people who preach family values have created rules that abandon children. Please don't let Minnesota children pay the price for federal neglect. I thank you for listening to me. Any questions, Chairman?
No, thank you for testimony and for your work as well. Any questions, members? Well, thank you for coming down.
Sure, today. Thank you.
Mrs. Opsahl. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me a chance to speak this afternoon. I just have very brief remarks. My name is Irene Upsall. I'm an attorney, and I supervise the work of the Youth Law Project of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. All of my clients are children who live in Hennepin County. Part of our work involves representing children who come to the attention of child protection, and we represent those children by working with their families and with other professionals who are involved with their families to be sure that services are in place to allow those children to live safely at home or with extended family. And when out-of-home placement is necessary because of safety concerns, we work to be sure that the child returns to the care of the family as soon as possible. We've heard a lot of information today and some sobering information and statistics about what the effect of these rules will be on the children in Minnesota. And I'm here to bring your attention to just one additional result that I believe results from inadequate funding of child protection and child welfare services. And that is the fact that reduction of county contracts with community-based service providers will undermine county efforts to address racial disparity in out-of-home placement. We know that there's disparity in out-of-home placement rates and that African-American and American Indian children are much more likely than their peers to be placed away from home when child protection gets involved. Counties have been establishing programs and approaches aimed at addressing and reducing this disparity. And one tactic that many counties have used is to contract with community-based service providers. families may establish a better, more open working relationship with community-based service providers because of their fears, well-founded or not, that involvement with the county will mean loss of their children to foster care. When parents feel comfortable with a service provider, we know from our experience working with children and families, when parents feel more comfortable with a service provider, they're more likely to candidly discuss their needs and identify and use services that will address those needs and keep their children at home and out of foster care. Preventing the need for foster care placement is good for children, and loss of preventive services, as we've heard from other presenters today, means that more children will end up in more costly types of out-of-home placement, and that's not good for families or for children or for our state and county budgets. Reduction of funding means a reduction or elimination of county contracts with community-based service providers, and that would be a bad outcome for children and their families. Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Opsahl. You basically have said, I was sitting here waiting for all of the testimony to be done before I said exactly what you were going to say. And so I thank you for your comments. You know, it's one of those things that we all are concerned, and it's a shame that we're having this conversation because we're dealing with the most vulnerable individuals in our state that need these services, need to be watched more, need assistance in making sure that they can be in the community, get back to families, etc. But one of the things that we're already finding out with the smaller based community services, because of the crunch that the counties are filling in the preparation, in addition to the preparation of the cuts, they're already sitting cutting back because of other fundings that we're not giving to the counties. That they're cutting back on their contracts to community based, especially culturally specific, I can't even get it out today, services that are being provided, not just in out-of-home placement, but in also mental health services, and watching what some of those families are going to be doing, and especially those that have been with contractors for years and feel very comfortable. The other thing that, you know, wanting to mention that is on my mind and on my heart today is, you know, with all things being equal, before the cuts have been had, before the recent years and those cuts, the disparities for children of color, in particular African-American children in out-of-home placement, Minnesota consistently is one of the worst outcome states in this country. And now we're talking about drastic cuts that are going to be impacting counties, impacting the state, and most importantly, impacting children and families. And we're cutting out services that we know that benefit these families, community-based, caseworkers, and things of that nature. I'm looking forward to see how the legislature responds, and not just coming up with TCM funding, but are we really going to deal with the fact that Minnesota does not do well with all children, that it picks and chooses which types of children that we want to fare well with. And it shouldn't be just solely because we don't have the money to provide the services for all of our children. It should be that we're looking at opportunities to make sure that all children have a really good start and moving forward. And some children do need more services and more funding and resources and community-based opportunities than others.
Thank you very much. I did have one other, maybe for the counties, just one other question or a second. On the waivered services side, can someone just talk a little bit about how this would affect waivered services?
Mr. Chair, committee members, unfortunately this is another one where we're not really sure. This is part of the unclear part of the Deficit Reduction Act. If you look at the Act, or if you look at the regulations in their, as they were printed, we initially thought there would not be a great deal of impact on the waiver services. The telephone calls, as the department has talked about, that said it would apply to all case management services, made us realize that it could very well impact waiver services. So we're preparing that there would be a reduction in the amount of case management money for waiver services as well. The additional...
Can you just explain how the case management money works in waiver services?
In waiver services? Yeah. Yes. In waiver services, we are already, the counties are already billing at a 15-minute increment rate for the most part.
So that would not be impacted. Some of the impact that we would anticipate is what is allowed and not allowed might change so that some of the services we're currently billing for we can no longer bill for. The additional piece it has to do with the freedom of choice and the administrative, you know, what is administrative money as opposed to what is case management money. So it's a lack of clarity in that respect, as well as many times the case managers, particularly for the MRRC waiver, the mental retardation related conditions waiver, are also making determination about what services will be allowed. And so there's some concern in that respect that they are limiting services and that would not be allowed. And yet that's part of their mandate that they look towards safety of the client.
Thank you. Anybody else have any questions today that they want to ask? Representative Shepard.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for having this hearing because I've been reading about this rule change for a while and I haven't fully understood it today until I've heard the testimony of the witnesses and the excellent handouts, especially from AMC and from Christine Bronson from the Department of DHS. And I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if you've thought or if other members of the committee have thought about adding our committee's support to the call for withdrawing these rules. And if you've thought about that at all, taking any kind of action along that line?
Only as I was sitting here today. So so maybe we can think about trying to do that, even if something short.
Yeah.
And that people can sign on to one paragraph short. And I'll write it. I was thinking the same thing. So we can talk after.
That's fine. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that.
Monday. Right. We'll have to do it short. Yes, shortly. I can write fast. Any other comments? Well, thank you everybody for coming down today. This has actually been very helpful. I still have a lot to learn about this whole area. We don't spend so much time on it, but I appreciate it. We'll see everybody next week, I guess. Next Wednesday. We're adjourned.